Welcome to Triple Your Trading Profits, and we've got a follow-up telephone call here. This is just post the event where we had an absolutely fantastic event, and we had a few people put in submit some questions for Stuart and I to answer, so I've got those. Stuart, are you on the line?
Dave.
Excellent. Thanks for joining us this morning. I think we've got some really fantastic questions, so we might as well get stuck straight into them, and we'll see how we go. So the first question I've got here is, it says, do you have a ratio of liquidity / position sizing?
Okay, I think I remember us talking about this when we were talking about position sizing and liquidity being such an important time-tested rule, you know, demand liquidity in stocks that you're trading and active turnover. A ratio, a standard rule of thumb that people often suggest is 10%. Now, what I mean by 10% is if you determine the stock that you're interested in trading, if you, calculate its average turnover is, let's say, $100,000, and we're using a 10% guide for our position size, what we want to make sure is our typical position size isn't in excess of 10% of that active turnover. For example, $10,000. So if our position size was going to be $25,000, let's say, yet the average turn, you could probably draw the conclusion that's not active enough. It doesn't have enough turnover and enough money going through it on a regular basis for to make it easy for you to get in and out of that stock whenever you need to. So 10% is a pretty standard rule of thumb.
Excellent. You mentioned the average volume, Stu. What's a good way to calculate that? I suppose, obviously, moving average multiplied by the price, but with what sort of time frame do you think you should be looking at?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, you could just look back, say, a month or two, and let's call that 21, 42 sort of trading days. Let's call it 40. So you just take a 40-day average of the volume, give you an idea of average volume. Perhaps you can, you know, multiply, include the price in there, and which will give you the turnover or an estimate anyway, certainly of the number of dollars going through the stock on a regular basis. So
I suppose that the key there, one point, I suppose it wasn't so much that there was a magic number. As long as you go far enough out that you're going to get a good representative of volume, you don't want to be taking a moving average over 3 days just because there might have been significant volume in the last few days, but that's not really going to be representative. So like you said...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, and just what you're saying, then you may have a stock that doesn't trade for 3 weeks, announces something, perhaps even a director sells to another director, so that turnover is reflected, and you just get a single spike in volume on 1 day or 2 days for an extraordinary event, yet the last 4 weeks it hasn't traded one stock. So that's why I think it's important not just to look at today's volume and go, oh, wow, look, there's 120,000 stocks change hands. You need to go back and get consistent turnover.
And I think the reason that popped into my head is because, well, during one of the breaks, someone came up and asked me about calculating the ATR as well, and they wanted to know over what period you should calculate an ATR. And I suppose when you're calculating the average true range, the key word there for me is the word average. To get an average, you really do have to, you know, select a slightly longer time frame. Otherwise, you're not really getting an average. You're only getting a real small snapshot. I suppose it would also depend on what time frame that you're trading. But did you have any thoughts on perhaps a value that you might use for the ATR?
And agree with what you just said. I guess it's probably like any statistics. You need to get a sufficient sample. So just looking over the last 2 days and getting the average true range really isn't an accurate indication or reflection. Because it's not sufficient sample. So, I mean, just to throw a number out there, let's just say 15 or 20, let's say minimum 15. So yeah, at least you've got a few weeks of data there to get a reflection of the average of the true range.
Perfect. All right. So, well, moving on to the next question I've got here. Would you buy close to overhead resistance?
Yeah, it's a fair question, and it's one I'm often asked, and it's, to me, this comes down to being a balancing act. For example, we identify resistance at, say, $2, and right now it's trading at $1.97, $1.98. Now, we think, deep down, I really like this stock as a potential trading opportunity. I feel good that it is going to break through the resistance at $2 and continue on. So would you buy close to that resistance is saying now, I think it's going to get through. Let's pick it up a little bit cheaper at $197, $198. rather than waiting for it to break through and having to pay, let's say, $204, $205 for it. So you're getting it for a little bit cheaper. Personally, I don't do that. Personally, I want to have a methodology which looks for high probability trades. So if I can compare those two situations, if it's trading at $204, $205, to me, it now has a far greater probability of moving higher than what it did when it was $1.97, when it still had the resistance to get through before it could go any higher. So I guess I'm paying a premium for that high probability, and that premium is I don't get it for $1.97, I have to pay $2.05 for it. But personally, I'm perfectly happy to do that. So to me, it's a real balancing act.
Perfect. I think that answers that one fantastically. Moving on to the next one I've got here. Can risk be too small, i.e. there's the 2% rule that we're all familiar with. Would 0.05 be too small?
Depends. I mean, I like the idea of perhaps having, you know, 2% should be the maximum, but I really like the idea of people exploring the idea of using a lot less than that. So, you know, 1.5% or 1% or even 5%. Half a percent, as this person has mentioned. When it can be too small is when your trading capital is too small. Because if you have a small trading capital on, let's say, $5,000 or $10,000, your risk at half a percent is, say, $50. And it really just doesn't allow you to buy sufficient stock to make it actually worth your while taking the risk or the trade in the first place. So I think the smaller your capital, the less flexibility you have with position sizing. But I think the more money you have, and let's move beyond 10 and go into multiples there of 10,000, let's say 20, 50, 80, $100,000, I think using a 2% rule is probably too much. And using a 1 or a 0.5% I think is fantastic. And I don't think it's too small at all if your trading capital is of sufficient size.
I do remember you saying on the day as well, Stu, which I heard before, the idea that a lot of amateurs may look at or new people to the market may look at 2% and go, oh, I'm risking not enough, I'd like to risk more. Whereas the professional investor usually would look at that and say, oh, you know, I want to risk less than that.
Yep, exactly. And I guess it comes down to those who are doing really well understand how important managing risk is and being conservative and doing everything you can to protect your capital. And, you know, we're like everybody. When we started, we didn't totally appreciate that. So it's pretty easy when you first start and you're really prepared to take risks that you don't do everything you can to protect your capital. So you think 2% is too small. You want to risk more than that because you want the big profit. You want the big winning trade. So, so those who are doing well appreciate that managing risk is vital. So we become more conservative and perhaps even, you know, minimise or reduce that risk capital that we set.
The next question I've got here is, as a trade becomes more profitable, do trailing stop loss become further and further away, i.e. 3 ATR moves to 4 ATR and then to 5 ATR? I suppose that's, you know, as the trade gets more and more into the trade and more profitable.
Sure. I personally don't do this, but having said that, I think it's a great idea because it totally supports the notion of when we move into a profitable trade, we want to become more and more risk-seeking because we're in profit. I mean, it's not a natural thing to do. We often become risk-averse in a profit. But we want to become more and more risk-seeking and give that trade every opportunity to continue to move higher. So the idea of actually just widening your stop a little bit, to me, actually complements that idea of giving it every opportunity to continue to move higher. As I said, I've never considered it and I don't do it, but I think it has a lot of merit.
Excellent. Moving on here, I've got number 5, which is, do you have any aspect in your trading plan for your own money to reduce position sizes if the overall market turns down?
No, not really. I mean, theoretically, if your trading capital reduces significantly, naturally your position size will reduce accordingly. So if you've gone from 100,000 to 80,000 and your position sizing model will be calculated off 80, so naturally your position sizes do get smaller, despite the very natural tendency to want to increase our trade sizes after a losing streak because we really want to get that money back, which is, of course, a recipe for not good things in our trading. So theoretically, the idea of reduced position sizes is a natural thing when you're trading, when your trading capital reduces in sizes. But what I often find, though, is if say the market has a real downturn, you know, a lot of my stops are triggered, so I exit, so a lot of the money comes back into the trading float and is not exposed in the market. And then for perhaps my more conservative medium-term approach, it'll be a little bit of time before opportunities start presenting themselves again. So naturally, I'm not just getting straight back into the market anyway. I might just have to wait a week or 2 or 3 weeks for things to settle down and go along their merry way. So that's my response to that anyway.
And I suppose that builds upon something I did, again, to recall on something that you said at the seminar, which was when we were talking about what a trading plan and a trading system is really there to do. And it's not so much to get you into the market or your views on what a trading system was to almost keep you out of the market when you shouldn't be in the market. So like you said just then, that whole idea of, okay, if the market has started to turn, your system almost becomes a barometer because you're not going to be receiving, you know, as many buy signals, obviously, if you're trading just the long side.
Yeah, exactly, and you'll find in your market scanning, exactly, just fewer and fewer opportunities present themselves. But I'm glad you mentioned that, Dave, because I do make a strong point of that, and that is your trading plan is designed to keep you out of the market, not get you in. So,
yep. So moving on here, we've got, do you recommend having all of your trading capital in active trades, or should some be kept as cash? And if so, what percent?
Good question, but it all depends. For example, my super fund, I always have roughly 10% in cash because, and this is probably more specific to Australian taxation law, that during the year you have an obligation to like pay tax, pay as you go. So I've always got that that account with about 10% of my capital. It's cash, it's secure, nothing had happened to it, and it allows me to fulfill that tax, those tax obligations throughout the year as I have to, you know, pay as you go. But again, that's probably more specific to our own tax law here. But having said that, if that isn't a requirement for you and trading opportunities present themselves, I see no reason why to keep some cash set aside. I mean, my account will never be zero because my position sizes are never that precise where I, you know, spend every single last cent. You know, I always base it on my position size. So I might have $300 left in the account or $900 left, but everything else is out should the market conditions allow that.
Yeah, I think as well, I'm in a similar frame of mind on this as well, in that if you're looking to trade the markets and you've set aside your trading float, that's your intended purpose for the money, assuming that you have got appropriate trading candidates. So my gut feeling would be you should have, whenever possible, all your money invested. Obviously, it comes back to your system making sure that you are getting the signals. You don't want to put the money in just for the sake of having all your money in. But I don't see any reason to limit, you know, I'll keep 10% of my trading float or whatever, just sitting in the account, just accruing interest. As part of, like, when you think of, you know, the way you structure your wealth creation, you'll have a certain amount allocated for your trading float, you'll have a certain amount allocated for your real estate, you'll have a certain amount allocated for, you know, just cash in the bank. But I see that as separate from my trading float. My trading capital, I've got that put aside to be traded. So if my system says there's a buying opportunity, then I wouldn't hold back just because I wanted to keep a certain percentage in my account. Also, just in regards to, I suppose this comes back to backtesting and things like that. When I do backtesting of systems, and I use TradeSim, and when doing backtesting of systems, you can actually see the utilization of your trading float, because you can enter in your trading float before, and you can see over a set period of time whether or not you're fully utilized or partially utilizing your cash. And I always try and get almost as close up to the top of that band as possible, so I'm as close to being maxed out as possible without being maxed out all the time. The reason I don't like to be maxed out all the time is because if you're maxed out all the time and then new trading opportunities pop up and you don't have any capital available, it's just going to throw out your back testing a little bit, because obviously it's going to open up with more trading opportunities that you may not have been necessarily able to open, it's going to throw your testing out, because depending on which trade you ended up taking could dramatically affect the ultimate end of your testing as to whether or not you made a profit or not, because of whether or not you took a particular trade. So that's why you need to introduce, if you are going to trade a type of system where you're constantly maxing out, where you look at Monte Carlo testing, which is that idea of saying, okay, well, what's the standard deviation of my trading system? How far is it between in my back testing results? What's the least most profitable scenario and the maximum most profitable scenario? And you'll find that gap widens the more that you fully utilize your cash. So that might have gone over the head of a few people, depending on whether or not they've done any back testing. But just bear in mind, I kind of like the idea of getting up as close as possible, but you don't want to necessarily be maxed out as possible when you're doing your back testing. Just moving on now, the next question was, you mentioned 150-day moving average, and this was in the presentation itself, Stu. You'd mentioned that there was a short... you mentioned you use 150-day moving average for some of your calculations, and the gentleman just wanted to know if you're using a simple moving average or an exponential moving average.
That was a simple. I've never used anything else but simple. Yeah, maybe I just like the word simple. You know, funny you should say, the person should ask that. There's obviously a difference between a simple and an exponential, especially with such a large time frame. But I've often, I've had a couple of people approach me who clearly had some mathematical, scientific background, who said, I can't believe you don't use an exponential or a weighted moving average, but you use a simple moving average. So, to me, not that I've explored it any further, there was obviously something behind that. There was obviously some mathematical reason why they thought, you know, an exponential was better than a simple. But just a simple test for people, perhaps. What, you know, something you can do, and I always throw back, is I bring up a chart and I put on a, say, an 18-day weighted moving average, and I put on a 13-day simple moving average. So different time frames. One's a simple, one's a weighted. And what you'll find is they're basically identical. They're exactly the same line. So far as practical application of those lines, then there's really no difference. So, I mean, it's a long answer to which what could have been a one-word answer, but I've never used anything else but a simple moving average.
Which I think comes back to a lot of what we would, or what you were talking about in the presentation, just in regards to your approach to the market. There are a few fundamental things that you follow, and one of the key ones is just making sure to keep it simple, because if you don't have a simple trading plan, you won't be able to follow it. So maybe it is the word that simple that grabs your attention there.
Yeah, it probably does. And you're right, I make such a strong point of that. Keep things simple. Simple works.
Cool. Moving on to number 8, we've got, for a short-term trader, 3 to 10-day trading period, what moving average should we be using?
Another question about moving averages. I personally don't necessarily like the idea of using moving averages over such a short time frame. I do use moving averages for more medium term, and I mentioned, and it was brought up in the previous question, I use a 150-day to determine the more medium to longer term parent sort of trend, higher term trend. When it comes to moving averages, everyone knows they're a lagging indicator. They take time to adjust and change direction. And when we're talking about short-term trading and using short-term trends, which, as the person mentioned, could last anywhere from, say, 3 to 10 days, I don't think they're really that useful, because they are a lagging indicator. To me, when we're trading short-term, what is far more important is individual bar analysis. So every single bar, whether it be a daily bar or hourly bar or whatever, let's call it a daily bar, to me, analysing all those bars to identify turning points, reversal signals, is far more important than perhaps using a moving average.
Perfect. Yep, that sounds great. Moving on to the next question I've got. Where can we get the ATR for Australian and US stocks?
Well, maybe it's easy for you and I, Dave, because we have Metastock with a data feed. And for all those who use Metastock, Metastock has an indicator called average true range, which, like any other indicator, can be applied to a chart and will tell you the value. And, of course, we have a data feed for Australian and US stocks, and we can do that. For those who don't have software and a data feed, to be honest, I actually don't know where you can get the value for average true range, which is, important in a way because I think it's such a useful tool. So whether software is the solution for those people, or I mean, there must be some other way of obtaining the average true range. But I've never had to go that far because I've always had it in Metastock.
Yeah, I think with the average true range, it's available in every charting package I've ever seen. So I think one of the tools of the trade these days, at least. I know you talked about people many years ago, prior to computers, still there were people successfully trading the markets. But for me personally, I almost would see it as a hindrance. You're just making things tough on yourself if you're not using a charting package these days, and that's a perfect reason for why. I suppose to a certain extent, sometimes you need to be careful because you can get, you know, analysis paralysis just because there's so many different indicators. But it's so easy in Metastock. You just drag your indicator down and you're done. So, next question 10 we've got here. You mentioned four books. Can you please list them? So this would be in reference to you, yeah. Stu. Yeah.
I did mention four must reads. Look, I don't think these are the four best books ever, but they're just ones that I often recommend to people as being, you know, as a good starting point. They're probably, for all four of them, well under $200, and it's the best $200 you'll spend. Number one for me was Market Wizards by Jack Schwager, and I mentioned that during the day, and I don't think there's any secret. So that book has probably had the single most greatest influence on my own trading, just reading the interviews and going back over what people said. And I think the way people came across as being so simple in their approach, and they made things very simple. Mm. Another book I mentioned in my must-read list is by Mark Douglas called Trading in the Zone. Otherwise, another book, one I mentioned on the day, is Dr. Van Tharp, and that is Trade Your Way to Financial Freedom. And the fourth book in my must-read list is Secrets for Profiting in Bull and Bear Markets by Stan Weinstein. Perhaps we'll just make a list of those and we'll put them on the download page.
Yep, that's a fantastic idea. And I suppose you can't go past as well Stuart's book, Trading in a Nutshell. I just thought I'd throw that in there for you, Stu.
Thank you.
it's funny because when you read that book, you can see Stuart's taken almost like the best bits from all of the research that he's done and put it into one place. So that's definitely something worth checking out. And already we're up to the second edition for that. So clearly it's a popular book. So Trading in a Nutshell by Stuart McPhee. And the other one I wanted to throw out there was, which I quite enjoyed, doesn't really go so much over any specific methodology as such, like doesn't detail it, but there's a book by Nicholas Darvas, How I Made $2 Million in the Stock Market. And he goes over a few, it tells the story of his life, and I find that fantastic because it sort of breaks down, and there are so many lessons to be learned as you're reading it. He doesn't actually detail his exact method, but the lessons learned make it definitely worthwhile. Moving on, we've got number 11. If you're comfortable with and making better results in your trading portfolio, why don't you use the same method in your super fund, a.k.a. 401k if you're in the States? Also, do you calculate your stops differently in your super than your trading fund?
That's a very fair question that person asks, and I totally appreciate where they're coming from. But to me, they are just so, so different. Probably the biggest difference between the two is the amount of money in both. I have a lot more in my super fund than I do in my day-to-day trading fund, but I do appreciate the question, but they're just so different. And the purpose of both of those accounts that I trade is just so different. My trading fund, as much as I don't want to, I could afford to lose it tomorrow and I'd be a bit upset, but I'd get over it pretty quickly. It wouldn't ruin me. The last thing I want to do is lose all the money in my super fund. So I'm so conservative and defensive and also thinking much longer term in my super fund than I am in my day-to-day trading fund. So just completely different purposes, and to me they just require completely different approaches. As I said, I don't want to, but I could lose my trading portfolio, and it wouldn't hurt me financially, but I couldn't say the same about my super fund, and I want that to just grow and grow over time. So when I, by law, I'm able to tap into it, you know, it's all there and looking good and will set me up. But the question was asked about, I think, calculating stops differently, very, very different, and we mentioned that throughout the day at the workshop, that different, we all have the same rules and principles of cutting losses and letting your profits run, but the way we apply those rules across the different trading styles is very, very different. So, of course, I use very different stops in my super fund than I do in my very, very different stops, and one wouldn't work for the other, and vice versa. So they're certainly very different.
Again, to underscore, like we went over that this in the seminar a little bit, and we covered those few different methods for calculating stops. I'm curious though, Stu, are you using the same stop on your like method of calculation on your super fund as also trading your CFD trading fund as well? Obviously, the width is going to be different, but are you using the same method of calculation?
Oh, okay. So not the okay, the same method, no. I use a volatility base for my super fund, and I use a technical stop for my short-term trading.
Perfect. Excellent. Moving on to the next question, we've got number 12. What percentage does the price need to move above or below support and resistance to break the trend? In brackets, I've got barrier.
Okay, so to move, so for us to have been convinced that it has broken, I guess, through that support or through that resistance.
Yeah.
You know, I've never really thought about a percentage. I think it's more a visual of, you know, a clear break, the line piercing the resistance level, and percentage-wise, I might find it difficult on the spot to assign a percentage. I guess what we're looking, if the resistance, if thinking back to that previous example, if the resistance is at $2 and the price gets to 201, I guess theoretically it's broken that resistance, but to me it really hasn't yet. It hasn't substantially pierced that level. What we're ideally looking for is that breakthrough $2, continuing to move up beyond $2 up to, let's just throw numbers out there, 204, 205. So in percentage terms, we could say that's 2 or 3%. Then retrace back from that peak at 205, come back, and then ideally bounce back off that $2 level. So it was previously resistance. The breaker to me has now been confirmed that resistance level at $2 is now a support level, and then we move past that peak at 205 and continue higher.
Perfect. I suppose the real key there is just you come up with something, as Stu does, like something consistent the way that you approach it, and when you look at it, you think in the same mind each time, because I suppose you don't want to approach it from a too subjective point of view, or that's for me personally. And if you can come up with a way for what you consider a big enough break, but for me, I like with my scans, because obviously I use a lot of Metastock, and if I'm looking for my entry signal, usually what it'll get triggered after, even if it has broken above 1 or 2 cents, but where it closes is important for me. But I'm sort of doing more your end of day trading, because you might get a break above it, but then it's also important that it closes above it as well. Moving on to 13, I've got, I've heard that CFD brokers will force the price to take out your stop losses. Is this true, i.e. so they make a profit for themselves?
That's an interesting assertion. I've never actually heard of that happening. But bear in mind the second part about making a profit for themselves. Not that I'm saying they do things illegally, but remember, CFD providers, and the same with people who sell options and those who issue warrants, they're in it for one reason, and that is to make money. They're not a charity. But to me, the key with selecting a CFD provider is using someone that has direct market access. If you have a CFD provider that is a market maker, then yes, they can adjust they make the market. They can provide the bid and ask and perhaps adjust that within their own boundaries. If you use a CFD provider that has direct market access, then they are bound by the bid and ask for the actual physical underlying security or stock that CFD is issued against. So they're bound by whatever the market is. So in other words, they can't make the market. They can't move it to suit their own purposes.
Excellent. So I suppose just a matter of doing a little bit of research to make sure you pick it. But I'm sure as well that to a certain extent, there would be laws in place to prevent them, or people just wouldn't end. If that ended up happening, I imagine that people wouldn't even end up trading using that provider. as well.
Or they know no better. But one thing about market makers, and in options trading we have market makers, and even though they are within the laws of the market and an exchange traded option and being regulated and everything, some of the spreads that they can have on their bid and ask is actually quite wide. And I know in our market it can be up to 20%. Now that's an extraordinary gap between the highest bid and the highest offer, yet it's within the rules of the exchange. So, and because they make the market, they can make it as wide as 20%. So that's why I think direct market access is important.
And I suppose another thing there as well, the importance which we talked about on the day, making sure that you do some sort of analysis on liquidity, because the more liquid an instrument is, there's a greater chance, obviously, that the market is going to be reflective of what's actually happening.
Yep, exactly. Yep.
So moving on to 14, we've got, if everyone uses the ATR for a stop, would it be better to go with a little lower than the ATR, i.e. so you don't get stopped out with the crowd?
I understand why this question is being asked, but the bottom line is not everyone, in fact, the vast majority won't use ATRs for stops. So I don't think that's a real issue. And even those who do use ATRs, they'll use different multiples. Some will use 3 multiplied by the average range, others 3.5, others 4, others 5. So I don't think that's an issue at all.
Perfect. So moving on to number 15, you've spoken a lot about exits and risk. What about reward? How do we determine a target when the share price is at a new high? Fibonacci, question mark, and i.e., there is no use in taking a trade or risking $1 to make $1. Rather, risk $1 to make $2, the risk-reward ratio at 1 to 2. I would normally use support and resistance. However, new highs don't have support and resistance.
Good question to ask about risk-reward. And I do talk a lot about exits and risk, and I do that for a very good reason. But it's a good question about potential reward. I personally don't set targets, and I made that quite clear during the day. But the other thing with determining a target for new highs is I don't think you really can. To me, and I mentioned this during the day, I often buy stocks at new highs. When you're at new highs, the sky is the limit. So to me, theoretically, the potential reward is almost unlimited. Now, that's very theoretical because that's never going to happen. But to me, the sky is the limit, and it really can. The reward, potential reward in this trade can be really significant. So I don't think we just limit ourselves and I mean, we're almost just, in a way, almost guessing and trying to work out, oh, well, it's broken through $2, I think it'll get to $2.40. I really don't have much, I don't have anything in place where really I set a target like that purely to come back and work out a risk-reward ratio. To me, the beauty of buying at new highs is potentially the reward is, the potential reward is almost unlimited.
Yeah, and I think to add to that as well, when you enter into a position, and we talked about this again on the day about, well, what things do you know, what things do you have control over and things like that. One of the things that you don't have control over is what the market's going to do. So there's no real way for you to know what your potential reward is going to be. The market's going to tell you that because you set whatever your trailing stop is. And then it may run for, you know, 1 or 2 days, or it might run for 1 or 2 months or 1 or 2 years. You have no idea. What you do know is what you can define at the start, which is how much risk you'll take on. But I don't think you'll ever be able to tell, you know, how much reward you're going to make without doing some sort of a, you know, maybe backtesting or something like that to figure out that way. But before, when you hop into a trade, you should really approach each trade independent, and Stu talked about that on the day as well, that whole idea that just because you may have had, you know, a string of losses doesn't necessarily mean that the next one's going to be a profitable trade. Just moving on to question 16, we've got, you mentioned not to buy something that looks cheap. What about buying when the market tumbles, a credit, in reference, e.g. a credit crunch?
I guess they're talking about the one that happened August or so, 2007. I do believe in not buying something that looks cheap. But having said that, if people are comfortable taking that risk and buying things because they've just tumbled and they see a great opportunity and a buying opportunity and something is cheap and it's a bargain, I can't say that's wrong. I mean, there's no clear distinction that's a wrong approach. That is an approach. It's just not something I would do. And I think over time, it's probably not the best approach. And we've seen examples recently where stocks have just been completely belted. Individuals, for specific fundamental reasons, have been completely belted one day, and everyone thinks, this has now just dropped, you know, 67%. What an absolute bargain. And then what does it do the next day? Drops another 25%.
Yeah.
So it's just not something I do. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. It's just, I think it's important to not buy things just because they've fallen a long way, because it may be a long while before they get back up if they, in fact, return to previous prices.
Yeah, I suppose there's no doubting that you can make significant gains, you know, if you happen to pick the bottom, but it is risky business to try and bottom pick, and there's that age-old thing or that joke you hear people talk about, you know, if you're picking bottoms, you're sure to get dirty fingers or something like that. But the moral of the story being that you could try and pick things as they're going down, but a lot of the time, you know, just because it's cheap doesn't mean it's not going to get any cheaper. So, and that, I suppose, comes back to the style of trading that both Stu and I do, which is more that adhering to that classic rule of the trend is your friend. So you want to be trading with the trend, not against the trend. It's not to say you can't make money trading against the trend, but I feel like you're stacking the odds in your favour if you're trading with the trend. Moving on to question 17, what moving average do you use to determine a technical stop?
I don't personally use moving averages. I use moving averages, and I use them solely for my analysis and entry decision. But once I'm in a trade, for short-term trading, I use a technical stop, and which is not moving average based. And for my medium-term trading, I use volatility based. Let's call it a trailing exit. What moving average? Because moving averages are quite handy for trailing exits. Look, I don't think it's a right or wrong number. You don't want to make it a 5-day moving average because it'd be too close for medium term trading. Just apply a few different moving averages on a chart of a typical stock that you would like to be in that trade for, like for a period of time. What I mean by that is look at a chart that's done really, really well over the last 3 or 6 months, and then try different moving averages to see which one did a really good job of allowing the stock to continue to move high. And you'll probably find something around the 30 or 35, 40, 45 sort of day moving average will do quite well.
Excellent. Moving on, the next question here I've got, this one we might actually need to make a video for. It just mentions, please explain how the ASX, which is the Australian Stock Market, pre-open ask and bid matching works. So I think...
Because I mentioned that during the day as being important.
Yeah.
No.
I think with that particular one, what I would like to do, I know for anyone who has gone ahead and attended the seminar or purchased the home study course, will get a special download page with, you know, a whole host of extra bonuses, including some extra little videos and things like that. So we might get Stu to make a video on that one, and we can post it on there.
Yeah, that'd be fine. I certainly can't explain it over this, so let's make a little video and explain how it works.
Excellent.
Good idea.
And then lucky last question I've got for today. Perhaps we'll cut it short because we're going a little bit longer and we can pick up where we left off in our next audio. But the last question I want to go over today is, what books do you recommend for reading for both short-term and medium-term trading?
Well, look, there's so many books out there, and I mentioned my previous four, the must-reads, although only one of those really tackles technical analysis and looking at charts, and that's the Sam Weinstein book. The rest are more mindset and trading plan sort of method, you know, developing sort of books. What about, Dave, the one you mentioned, the Nicholas Darvis book? Would that be something you'd recommend?
Nicholas Darvis, that would be sort of for more your medium to longer-term trading. I think that would definitely hit the bill there. And then if you also, for medium, longer-term trading, another, if you do some research on any of the turtle trading books that you can get your hands on, I think they're fantastic for medium to longer-term.
Okay.
And with that, I suppose we might wrap up this particular audio. We've gone through some fantastic questions, and I suppose a big part of the Triple Your Trading Profits program is that we want to make sure that we get all of your questions answered. So if you have any further questions after listening to this, make sure you submit them through to Stuart and I, and we can add them into the additional MP3s that we'll be doing following up from this. So with that, just want to say thanks, Stu, for jumping on the line. And
thanks, Dave. No, my pleasure.
Helping answering those, and look forward to chatting with you soon.
Okay. Thanks, Dave.